Accession number 19865, Reel 3.
Donald Robbins, Reel 3.
Earmarked as being someone who would attain high command in the army because he was clearly on top of his job and was a very accomplished officer. I was surprised, therefore, some years later to find that he'd only gone one rank higher and had retired as a lieutenant colonel. But obviously a highly respected lieutenant colonel, because he had the job when I was working in London as the adjutant of the Royal Hospital Chelsea. And I was very pleased to be able to make contact with him again and have lunch on a couple of occasions down there with him. But as I say, I was disappointed that he hadn't made a greater impact on the army, but I suppose there was a lot of competition. But the gunners served us extremely well, and I've been at pains to point out on other occasions that although the Dukes take pride in the fact that during the Battle of the Hook, which was the last major battle of the Commonwealth Division before the peace was signed, the Dukes take pride in that they held the Hook. They couldn't have done it without the support of the gunners. The gunners played a major role in that battle, and it was said that there was more artillery fired that night in support of the Dukes than was fired at the barrage prior to the Battle of El Alamein. The tanks also, although less prominently involved, the tanks also gave great support, and to have one or two tanks in the battalion area that could come up and give support or take out a slit trench with their 17 pounders and provide searchlights, again, great support. The engineers also produced a massive amount of support, particularly on the Hook feature, where they had working parties constantly helping the company repair defences, digging bigger and better and deeper bunkers. And the fact that we got away with comparatively light casualties was the fact that the shelters and the bunkers that had been constructed were sound. And we're talking about having 12 feet of overhead cover to withstand the heaviest shell. It's ironic that some of the heaviest shells that were coming in were from guns that the Chinese had captured from the Americans earlier in the war. One of the other little things that we as the signal platoon ran, apart from running the main signal exchange, was the SDS, or Special Delivery Service, in other words, the internal mail. And so that any written paperwork that required to go forward or come backwards came through the signals office, and we had a regular run twice a day to take forward correspondence and what have we. The normal soldiers' mail didn't come through us, but all the official mail came through us. And again, it was another little group who sorted the mail and ran the system and made sure things got back. Written reports, again, one area of concern was that bomb reps and shell reps, which are written reports on shell fire or mortar fire, which were helpful to the counter-bombardment people at the back, who would assess what size caliber it was and where it had come from, and one was meant to get fragments. Occasionally we got the odd unexploded shell or mortar bomb being passed back in a sandbag with a shell rep on it and saying, this one came in and didn't explode. So there was a certain amount of caustic humour going on at the time. The signal platoon, the battalion strength was around about 1,000. I think at one point we went up to 1,200 when we got a lot of reinforcements. The signal platoon strength was far in excess of its authorised establishment. At one point I had 120 men in the signal platoon. If and that was more than we needed, but that was a time when we got replacements for national servicemen before they'd actually left. But if I got down to 90 men in the signal platoon, I was getting short-handed. We were unfortunate to lose a signals officer wounded quite early on, not on the first position we were in, but on the second position. John Reddington, who was, as I said earlier, the original signals officer, and therefore the expert. The rest of us were novices or makey learny. John was wounded. He was trying to, on an air position called Nairtron, was taking some signalers forward to a company, and wrongly decided to take his vehicle forward along what was known as the camouflage road, contrary to the instructions that applied at the time. But he decided that because it was important he got these bodies there, he should do it. But it was a position where the Chinese could see a vehicle moving, and then they would mortar the area in front where they knew it had to go. And his vehicle was mortared, and he was wounded. Fortunately for the rest of them, he was the only one that was hurt. But he lost an eye as a result, and was backloaded. So that it meant then that I was the only signal sergeant, and Nick Norton, who was the signal subaltern, were the two left without the so-called expert John Reddington. So we managed for the rest of the campaign with Nick and I ran the platoon. And as I say, it was a fairly changing. None of the national servicemen that started the war actually finished it, or few, I don't think. And so it was a changing group all the time, with the need to train them before we put them in. I think I'd like to take a break there and just see what else.
Did you have any contact yourself with Korean civilians?
One saw them. I can't say I had contact, no. Not that I'm going to put on the record.
So you didn't use them to work for you?
Oh, yes. I mean, we had Korean... Well, we had Korean porters who were Korean army but were working with us as porters. We had houseboys. I had a Korean houseboy out of the line. We didn't take them in the line, but there were... Yes, we when we were in Divisional Reserve, and the whole Commonwealth Division was pulled into reserve, we'd had houseboys, and we saw Koreans. I mean, when I was driving backwards to the Ordnance Field Park, one saw a lot of Korean villages. One went through villages, and there was a certain amount of trading going on. The trade was, have you been told about the trade in beer bottles?
No.
Well, the British Army, I better talk about this. The British Army was still allowed beer. And in theory, the ration was one bottle, or the entitlement was one bottle of beer per man per day. And it was Japanese beer, Asahi beer, which came up in pint bottles. They were frozen solid in the winter, and you had to sort of get them melted out before you could drink them. And when we were in Div Reserve, there was quite a lot of beer drunk. And the bottles then were tradable in the local village. You could go and trade your bottles in. And milk cans, any tins from compo rations, they would take as well. And out of that, they would make little lamps. The tin of a condensed milk tin would make the bottom, and they would fashion a wheel and a wick, and then melt the glass down and then make a globe.
Who's this?
The local Koreans. And so there was quite a lot of trade in bottles, particularly, as I say, when soldiers were allowed to drink a bit more when we were in reserve. And the bottles became quite a money earner, as it were, for sort of company canteens, where they actually got cash in some cases for them. I mean, I wasn't involved so much with the bottle trading, but it did go on. And I had a houseboy who, when we were in reserve, used to sort of just keep the tent tidy and clean your boots and this sort of thing. And he was happy. I used to give him some cash as well. But there was a 50 tin of cigarettes per week, which he could sell on the local market for something extraordinary. And he was happy, you know. They were actually trading, saying, we make you learning cookie and this, that, and the other. And all they wanted was cigarettes. So there was that, yes. But as I say, the bottle trade. But we didn't have any... there was one operation where we, in reserve, there were some allegations of theft, not from us, but theft from other military units, where we had to go and cordon a village and search, which was a little bit unfortunately, because so poor. And to go and try and find stolen property in their sort of hovels was degrading to both sides, I thought at the time, because I've had more experience of it since in Cyprus and other areas of searching civilian homes, but it's not there. I like the story of where they had one house, they thought they'd made a great find because there was a sort of 50-gallon oil drum full, and they thought, we've got these buggers, you know, they've been stealing oil. And it was a friend of mine who was a platoon sergeant, and they eventually got this cap off this drum, and it was full of urine. And they, of course, they saved all their excrement and the urine to put back on the fields. And he said that everybody was very deflated when they found it was full of piss. So they let them keep that. I don't know. I mean, I've got nothing that I can say about civilians, really.
Did you have a leave period yourself in Japan?
Yes, I got 5 days in Japan. And... a few days down at Incheon as well. There was another local leave centre at Incheon, which I went to after the war was over.
What was it like on leave?
Oh, terrific. I mean, to be able to go to Tokyo and see Tokyo was... I think I drew my life savings out, which amounted to about £40, which was quite a lot of money in those days. And... the leaf camp was quite well run, just outside Tokyo. But of course, we didn't spend a lot of time in the leaf camp. Well, if you got enough money, you found a girlfriend and you went and stayed in a hotel. Or you went to the hotel and they found you a girlfriend. And I've often said that if she hadn't had slant eyes, and I could have married that girl, but she spoke perfect English, and she worked full time on the international Tokyo International Exchange, and spoke beautiful English, and a very attractive girl. But I mean, she was earning extra cash on the side, and of course one went through all the bathing rituals, and getting washed before you get in the bath, and that sort of thing.
What did you think to the Chinese enemy?
I think we all respected the Chinese, in as much that the Koreans and the Chinese are very hard people. The Koreans are particularly hard, hard personalities and hard fighters. And I think the Chinese are very similar. I didn't see any at close hand. Apart from a dead one, I was up when we did the daylight raid. Oh, maybe I should talk about the daylight raid. And they brought a dead Chinaman back. They thought he was alive, but he was dead by the time they got him back. And but they were pretty tough. And I mean, one of the things that our people respected the Chinese for, there was a lot of patrolling, a lot of night work, and the Chinese were very good at night, to the extent that at Christmas time we were in the line at Naecheon over Christmas, and the forward companies found Christmas cards and little presents hung on the wire when it came light regularly, and they'd no idea the Chinese had been at the wire. And it was a revelation to them, in many cases, that the Chinese in the night had been on our wire and our people hadn't heard them or seen them. I mean, they weren't going to get into the location because there was a hell of a lot of wire. But they brought Christmas cards and they stuck banners up and this sort of thing. And of course, they played the music on some locations. They had the sort of psychological warfare going on. And I don't know what they called a Tokyo Rose, was the World War II, but the equivalent of Tokyo Rose, a girl speaking in English and saying, oh, I'm talking to you tonight, why are you here in Korea? The Americans are in England sleeping with your wives and girlfriends and this sort of thing. And then play music. And of course our chaps quite enjoyed the music and there was no chance of our chaps, you know, getting worried by that. And then occasionally the gunners would put some fire down to try and hit the speakers. And our chaps would be very cross about that. Because they wanted to hear the music. But of course, there is the risk that whilst our chaps were listening to the music, that patrols were creeping up to them and what have we. But so that all went on. But I think our people in the main greatly respected the Chinese soldiers.
What was your state of health in Korea?
Me personally?
Yes.
Yeah, fine. Fine. I mean, the weather in the winter, the cold was extreme at night, sometimes during the day, but very often during the day you'd get sun and clear, and you'd wander around in the daytime with just pullover. I mean, you had a woolen shirt and a string vest on and combat trousers, but you could wander around in pullover and no gloves during the day. At night, of course, it was extremely cold, and it was a particular problem for standing patrols who had to go out and lay up. And whereas normally you would probably leave them out all night, in some cases you couldn't leave them out more than about 2 hours because they're just laying in the open and couldn't move, and you had to bring them in. And it was a problem, and communication, of course, to them was also a problem, in as much that we did actually manufacture a whispering microphone, small mic built into a cigarette tin with loads of wadding around it, which we sent back. We desperately needed things like that in Korea. Patrols lying out in the open couldn't speak clearly. You needed something where you could speak. And we, as I say, manufactured these things. Again, the microphones we'd had to beg, borrow and steal off the Americans, and then manufactured them around with foam rubber and plastic adhesive bandage from the medical centre, and make a sort of face mask out of it. And of course, in many of the patrols resorted to just pressing the Prestel switch on their microphone, not to speak, but to use the Prestel switch and saying, is there anything happening, or are you all right? One press for yes and two presses for no, sort of thing, because they couldn't afford to speak over the radio. Or in some cases, we had telephones out to standing patrol positions.
Did the political aspect of the war mean anything to you?
Yes, in as much that we knew why we were there. We knew that the North had invaded the South and that we were there as part of a United Nations force to prevent that and to put it right. And it was fairly soon after World War II when the United Nations had been formed with that object in mind. So we saw it as United Nations working. In more recent years, the United Nations hasn't always worked quite so effectively. They've tended to sort of perhaps pick and choose which conflicts they would get involved with. But yes, we were there. On the other hand, I agree with a chap who, in proposing a toast to the regiment at the dinner this year, was talking about why do people fight, why do soldiers fight. And he was in Korea, and he said, well, when we were in Korea, we didn't fight the Chinese because we had some high-minded ideals of world, you know, world right and moral wrong. We fought because we joined the army and the country said, go there and do this. And he said, when you're on the ground, you stand and you do what you have to do. You do it because you're part of the regiment and you don't want to be seen to be letting, but above all, you do it because you don't want to be seen to let your comrades down. And he said, so it's a very personal and family thing when you really get down to it. It's not the high-minded ideal that sometimes is attributed to it.
You mentioned the Americans and I think the Canadians. Do you have any recollections in Korea of any of the other allies?
Yes, we took one position over from the French Canadians, which we met the Australians as well. The Australians, I think, are very good in action. They're very ragtag, bobtail and ill-disciplined. And most of the ones that were most indisciplined were actually ex-Brits. You know, they weren't dyed-in-the-wool Aussies that had been born and brought up there. They were Brits that had gone out and then joined the Australian Army. And they were certainly good on the ground, but they tended to take the mickey out of the Brit battalions because we wanted to do it by the book, and they said, you don't worry about that sort of thing. So each nation appears to have their own style. The Canadians were much more serious, difficult at times with the French Canadians, who sometimes would pretend they didn't speak English when you were pretty sure they did understand, but if it wasn't convenient, they sometimes didn't want to know. The Americans took over from us on one position, and of course they had different systems. They couldn't understand our system of digging in on the tops of the hills, the main features, and putting wire and mines down on the others and covering it with fire. They still believed in the sort of thin red line where you guarded, you had a line and you did it. And they'd say to you, what is your bug out position? So, well, we don't have bug out positions. Geez, man, you've got to have a bug out position. I said, well, no, we don't actually understand what you're talking about. But what they were talking about, they would have a line there of lightly defended, and if the enemy came, they would bug out to the main position, and they would then defend the main position for as long as they thought it was defendable. But then they would bug out to another location, then they would reattack the next day and retake that position. And so they couldn't understand that we were happy to sit on the top of a hill and say, no, this is where we're staying. We've got no plans to go anywhere else. And in some ways, they were much more professional than us. In other ways, they were very, very amateurish in our eyes. But it's a different army. But they're not all as bad as we sometimes try to paint them. And there were a lot of the Americans that I met, both when we took over from them and when I was negotiating with bottles of gin for radio equipment. They were very helpful, they were very professional, they were very knowledgeable. But in the position that they took over from us in Naecheon, we hadn't had a lot of problems there. We'd been patrolling, we'd had some shelling. And if you appear on the forward slope in daylight, you'll be shelled. And when they took over from us at battalion headquarters and they said, you know, how many times this month have you been shelled? And I said, well, you know, not very often. But they then apparently took them on as a quiet area. They started erecting marquees in sight of the Chinese. And then they were heavily shelled and they lost men. And we heard afterwards that they'd lost quite a lot of men there. And so they didn't have, in certain respects, the discipline not to put a tent up on the top of the hill where the Chinese could see it. And yet, in other respects, they were very professional. I mean, I went, in my dealings with them, you'd see signs all along the road, the fighting fist, the finest and the first, and all this. And you got to this area, and they were out the line. I reckon they were out the line, anyway. And I get to their place, and they're all in flak vests and steel helmets. And there's me in a berry, and, you know, I'd just come out the line where I didn't wear a flak vest and steel helmet in the line in battalion headquarters. And I said to the chap who was the communications officer or signals officer, why are all your people wearing steel helmets and flak vests? He said, because it's a $100 fine if in this location you're caught without a flak vest or a steel helmet. I said, but you're not in the line. I said, we're within the combat zone. And they worked on this, and by God, they imposed it. And I thought, well, you know, that wouldn't work with us, our chaps. If you said you're going to be fined $100 when you're in reserve for not wearing your steel helmet, your flak vest, our chaps would go ballistic. You know, they'd think you were unduly penalising them. Yet they accepted it as... So as I say, in some respects, they're very professional. But, no, it was a different war. And they had their own concepts, their own ideas. And I talked to some of them at fair length.